This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. This story has multiple parts. To listen to the entire story in one place, visit talltaletv.com/series. Steampunk Confederation by Roger Lay, Part 1 of 3. Chapter 1, Harry Lampeter. Harry Lampeter knelt by the side of his Norton motorcycle, laid his Lee Enfield over the saddle, and sighted at the airship as it chuffed past, half a mile away. The musket was a new design with a rifled barrel. His shot hit the airship's boiler, and a jet of steam and water gushed out. The rear propeller slowed and stopped almost at once. The ship was at the mercy of the wind. Its pilot, Telford Stephenson, would have to land and make repairs if he wanted to deliver the stolen ironclad warship plans to the rebel government in the north. Telford evidently hadn't heard the shot over the sound of the steam engine. Harry watched as Telford started the helium compressors and the airship lost height. Harry mounted his motorcycle and followed at a safe distance, riding on and off-road as necessary. A few miles away, the airship passed over a farmer walking his plowing team home. Telford shouted down at him, then threw a rope. Harry watched as he spoke to the farmer, then lowered down a sack of what had to be salt or sugar, currency these days. The farmer hitched the rope to the team of horses, and they hauled the airship towards the farmhouse, visible in the valley below them. Half an hour later, Harry saw Telford securing the dirigible with ropes and pegs near the entrance to the barn. Presumably, he needed its workshop facilities. Harry found a hill that overlooked the farm, lay down, pulled out his telescope, and kept watch on Telford for the next few hours, as he shaped a copper patch and cleaned the mating surfaces before he soldered it onto the boiler. As darkness fell, Telford stopped, washed in a horse trough, then knocked on the farmhouse door. The farmer's wife answered. She was a plump, middle-aged woman, drying her hands on her apron as she gestured him inside. Harry Lampeter, being an agent of the British government in London, had no intention of letting Telford deliver the warship plans to Edinburgh, the Northern Alliance's capital city. Seeing his chance, he walked quietly down the hill, climbed into the airship's open gondola, and searched for the stolen plans. He found them rolled up in a leather drawing tube, strapped to the pedestal of the ship's wheel. He had taken them out and stuffed them back into the side pocket of his leather riding coat when he felt the barrel of a revolver jabbed roughly into his back.
"I'll take them, if you don't mind," said Telford, chuckling as he slid the plans back out.
He stepped back.
"Turn around slowly, Harry. You know I'm a crack shot. You don't think I could mistake a bullet hole for a blown seam, do you?"
He held up the lead slug he'd found embedded in his boiler and raised an eyebrow.
"I knew somebody was after me. I'm glad it's you, though, Harry. I owe you a favor, since you carried me back over the lines to your field hospital at the Battle of Lincoln."
"How did you escape?" asked Lampeter.
"I didn't. They patched me up and sent me home as part of a prisoner exchange."
"Presumably you were all sworn not to take part in hostilities again," said Lampeter. Telford shrugged. Keeping the revolver aimed steadily at his prisoner's midriff, he threw open a pair of handcuffs.
"Put these on," he said. "You can sleep in the barn. The farmer will release you in the morning."
He gestured with his gun, and Harry walked through the large open doors. Telford checked his handcuffs, then roped them to the beam above his head. It wouldn't be a comfortable night. In the morning, he could hear Telford fussing with the airship's boiler and getting up steam. There was a conversation between him and the farmer, then the chuffing of the airship's engine, slowly receding as it gained height. The farmer came in and unlocked the cuffs. Harry walked out of the barn, rubbing life back into his wrists, and looked up at the airship gaining height. At about 1,000 feet, the aneroid triggers fired the charges he'd planted. The two rear support ropes parted, and the gondola fell from a horizontal to a vertical configuration. He could see Telford clinging to the wheel for dear life, his legs dangling and kicking, his top hat falling. The engine and boiler ripped free and fell towards the ground.
There was a satisfyingly large steam explosion as they hit. The airship, freed from much of its ballast, began a rapid ascent towards the stratosphere. Harry could hear Telford's screams and wondered if he would use his parachute or regain control before he reached 15,000 feet, the asphyxiation limit. Telford wasn't a bad sort. As youngsters, they'd both been scholars at the Royal Hospital Naval Academy near Ipswich. They'd played on the same rugby team, and there had been a certain amount of mutual experimentation in the showers. Anyway, Harry didn't want him dead. It was part of the London government's plan that Harry retrieve the original drawings and substitute counterfeits for delivery to the Northern Alliance. The ones he had handed to Telford had one small difference. They specified an increase in the thickness of the armor plating that would make the ironclad battleships top-heavy. It would almost certainly capsize when they launched it from the slipway of whichever Govan shipyard it was built in. He looked forward to reading about it in the Telegraph in about 2 years' time. He imagined a daguerreotype image of the ship lying across the Clyde, rendering the river unnavigable. That would give the Northern Allies something to think about. Lampeter patted the pocket of his coat and felt the wad of original plans safely deposited where he'd hidden them, just before Telford captured him. Telford's top hat, complete with leather driving goggles, fell at his feet. He reached down and picked it up, examined it for damage, and, finding none, placed it on his head, giving it a cheery pat.
"You'll be wanting your breakfast, then, supposing you can pay for it," said the farmer.
"No thanks, old chum. I'll have it at my club," said Harry as he strode off, bell-bottom trousers flapping.
A few minutes later, the farmer heard a motorcycle start. He saw it set off on the London road. The stranger's long hair trailed out behind him. He was wearing the hat and goggles. The hat blew off, and the farmer made a note to retrieve it later.
Chapter 2. Telford Stephenson.
I had to jump for it. Luckily, I was wearing my parachute. Normally, I don't bother. All those canvas and leather straps get in the way, and the buckles are always catching on things. Anyway, if you're cruising below 1,000 feet, the bloody thing won't open before you hit the ground. So I usually wear a safety harness, like ocean-going yachtsmen. As I was planning to fly higher than usual, using an upper wind to get to Edinburgh, I'd strapped on the old chute before I set off. When the explosive charges severed the rear cables of the gondola, I'd clung onto the airship's steering wheel, then climbed onto the pedestal as the ship rose rapidly into the freezing air. If I ever meet up with Harry Lampeter again, I won't hesitate. I'll blow his bloody brains out. I let him go, and this is how he rewards me. There was nothing I could do to control the ascent, so I jumped. I'd had no parachute training, although I'd read about landing with one's feet together and falling over, or some such. My initial worry was that I'd become tangled in the loose ropes and rigging as I left my beloved Estella to her spiraling journey up into the heavens. I fell free, and as the wind rushed past me, my chute opened like a beautiful white blossom above me. I allowed myself a few moments to enjoy the view as the temperature slowly rose and I dangled down towards the ground. Now, I know what you're thinking. Why would a man, living towards the end of the 21st century, be floating around in an airship driven by a steam engine? And you'd be right to ask this, as you sit there with your iPhones, your internet, your central heating, your television and music players. The answer is, of course, that wanker, Dr. Martin Riley. He that invented the clean burn system that drove the trash bots that litter the world like dead and rusting horseshoe crabs. It all seemed like a good idea at the time. Bots crawling around at all hours, cleaning up after us, collecting trash and taking it back to their depots for sorting. Every city and municipality on the planet bought into the idea and issued licenses to the franchisees. Sorting the plastics was the problem, though. The bacterium, Ideonella cicaensis, was originally found in a Japanese recycling plant decades ago, but Dr. Riley managed to improve it. He came up with a bacterium that could rapidly digest plastics of all types, leaving a viscous hydrocarbon residue that could be recycled.
"But wouldn't a bacterium that digests plastics be a little dangerous, Dr. Riley?"
I hear you ask.
"Nothing to worry about. It can't breed outside our fermentation tanks, and it has a short lifespan. It's all perfectly safe, ha ha,"
says the good doctor.
"So, no risk of them escaping and screwing up the whole world, then? No chance they'd start breeding and rapidly return us all to the steam age?"
Wrong on all counts, Dr. Riley. You can guess the rest. Here we are back in the Victorian age, 150 years after the old queen died. We have a much smaller population now.
"And the government in Edinburgh?"
you ask. Well, the Scots had the oil, didn't they? And although the sight of sailing boats making deliveries to oil platforms might seem anachronistic to you, to me, it seems perfectly normal. But in the meantime, I was about to make my first parachute landing a mile or two from where I set off. I arrived with a hell of a thump and lay for a while as my heart slowly stopped hammering and the trembling in my legs diminished. I stood up, folded my parachute, and plodded back to the farmhouse, hoping to get help from the farmer's wife.
"Madam, the scrap value of my airship's boiler alone is worth more than your paltry smallholding."
I gave an all-encompassing gesture. Her ignoramus of a husband was probably arranging the sale of my wrecked boiler and engine as we spoke. She stood, hands on hips, a sullen and uncooperative expression on her face. To add insult to injury, my top hat was firmly wedged on the head of this denizen of the Hertfordshire countryside.
"You can have the bike for the para thingy," she said, pointing at my bundle.
I handed over my rumpled silk parachute, and she seemed to cheer up as she fingered the material, no doubt imagining all the uses she could put it to. Underwear, curtains, pillowcases. It was worth a king's ransom by itself. I set off on the bone-shaking old bicycle, its tires stuffed with grass or similar, and headed for the nearest town, Letchworth, as a matter of interest. The salesman at Itchnailed Car Sales couldn't have been more helpful once I began to unstitch the hem of my coat and piled gold sovereigns on his desk.
"You'd prefer a steam buggy to one of the two-stroke petrol jobs, sir."
"I'm heading north, and I can't guarantee petrol supplies on the way. With a steamer, I can forage for fuel as I go." We retired to the local hostelry, and he stood me a fine lunch while his mechanics fired up the boiler of my new acquisition to raise steam for my journey. I intended to make my way to the A1 carriageway, and then on up to Glasgow on the A66. There's a certain engineer up there who can't wait to see these drawings and start work on the ironclad warship. She'll probably want to steam up the Thames in it and bombard the House of Parliament. She's a fiery thing, is Eileen, and God, how she hates the English. And, by the way, I waited until Harry was asleep and replaced the counterfeit plans in his coat pocket. I still have the originals. His clumsy substitution was far too obvious. Chapter 3. Family Affairs. Harry Lampeter arrived at the old Royal Naval Observatory building to report to his boss, Miss Rigby. The Secret Intelligence Service, MI6 as was, had taken the building over after the Americans bombed the Vauxhall Cross site 10 years before. There were those that said the bombing had been done with the agreement of the then SIS chief, the wielder of the green pen, Brigadier Crisp. The death toll had been quite shocking, but it hadn't included Crisp, who was briefing the Prime Minister at Downing Street at the time of the attack. The Yanks explained it away as an accident, but the CIA obviously didn't want any interference from the SIS as they proceeded with the incorporation of the United Kingdom as the 54th state of the Union. Harry clattered across the beautifully tiled floors of the observatory. He ignored the marble busts of long-dead admirals and politicians, the brass and steel naval instruments and telescopes displayed in alcoves, the classical pediments and fluted columns. A uniformed guard stood at Miss Rigby's polished mahogany door. He knocked, turned the brass handle with a white-gloved hand, and pushed the door open.
"Miss Rigby will see you immediately, sir."
Harry mock-saluted and walked in. His boss was sitting behind her desk, reading a report. She pretended not to notice him, but Harry wasn't to be intimidated by such puerile dominance tactics. He plunked himself down in the chair opposite and banged his cowboy-booted feet on top of her desk, one after the other.
"You all right, Miss Rigby? Have you missed me? Here's a present for you."
He chuckled as he tossed the ironclad warship plans onto the desk. They rolled over, and Miss R was forced to stop them before they fell to the floor. She turned her cropped head towards him, scowling, inserted her monocle, and unrolled the blueprints. She pulled out the main assembly drawing, discarded the rest, and held it flat on her desk. Running her fingers down the parts list, she stopped and peered closely for a moment.
"So, Lampeter, another screw-up. These are the wrong plans. These are the ones that we wanted the Northerners to work from. You didn't manage to switch them after all."
She glared at him.
"I switched them rather elegantly, I thought, Miss R. At the point of Telford's gun, I might add."
"Well, Telford must have switched them back," she hissed. "This drawing calls for the armor plating to be 1 3/8 of an inch thick. It should be 13/16 of an inch."
She threw the plans back violently. It was Harry's turn to catch them this time.
"Take your skinny ass up to Glasgow, retrieve the originals, and leave these in their place. Get it right this time, Lampeter. Think of the damage an ironclad could do if they build one before we can. You're an idiot, Lampeter. Now get out and get on with it!"
Miss Rigby was shouting and red in the face by the end of her tirade. Her monocle had dropped out and was hanging by its black string, swinging pendulum-like across the front of her mannish jacket. Harry grabbed the drawings, stood, and turned to leave. As he opened the door, he turned back.
"So, no chance of a blowjob then, Miss R?"
He passed through, chuckling. And, as he was closing the door behind him, he heard the sound of Miss R's heavy glass ashtray smashing into the other side.
"Repressed sexual feelings are a terrible thing,"
he said to the uniformed functionary and sauntered away down the echoing hallway. An hour later, Harry stepped from a steam omnibus outside a terrace of brick houses in Hackney. He walked down the steps to a basement flat. Ignoring the litter and smell of urine, he checked for the door key under a flower pot containing a dead and withered hydrangea. It wasn't there, so he knocked. The door was answered by a young woman wearing a corset, high heels, and a small bonnet trimmed with feathers and lace.
"Oh, hello, Harry. I was just trying this out. Do you like the hat?"
"I certainly do. I like the whole confection, Emma."
He followed her into the hall and through into the bedroom, where she stood in front of a full-length mirror, adjusting her headgear. Harry sat on the bed and watched her.
"I love the new tattoo,"
he said as he looked at the slightly romanticized rendering of Emma's friend and lover, Elsa Nielsen, on her left buttock. The image was wearing a small top hat with a bejeweled, skeletal hand on one side and a flower in the hat band. It looked red and slightly weepy.
"It cost an effing fortune, and it hurt like anything. It's still sore now, but then I only had it done yesterday."
Lampeter stood and began to undress.
"I'm knackered, Emma. Any chance of a quick one and a few hours' kip?"
"Only for you, you silver-tongued devil,"
she said archly as she pulled back the covers and climbed in.
"You watch out for the tat. I don't want it damaged."
Harry chopped two lines out on the glass top of the bedside cabinet. With a magician-like flourish, he produced an ivory snuff tube and offered it to Emma.
"After you, my love," he said.
Some hours later, Harry was pulling on his velvet bell-bottoms. He pulled out a handkerchief and tried to rub off the ink stains on his left thigh.
"Bullocks to it, it'll wear off," he muttered as he pulled his trousers up.
Meanwhile, Emma was standing with her back to the mirror, half-turned, examining her tattoo.
You've smudged it, Harry.
She was tearful.
I told you to be careful. You're always doing things like this. You only care about yourself. You don't give a toss about anybody else.
Harry put his arms around her and gently kissed her cheek.
I do care about you, Emma. I really do. Here, take this. I'm sure you can get it fixed.
He handed her a thin bundle of white 5-pound notes and stroked her shoulder.
Anyway, thanks for the bed and board, Emma. Say hello to your mom for me. Tell her I'll call around when I can.
She heard the door slam and Harry's footsteps as he climbed the steps up to the street. Then he was gone. Emma sighed and walked to the telephone and dialed her friend, Elsa. She looked at the fivers and ran a finger over the portrait of old President Trump on the top one. Elsa picked up.
Hello, love. It's me. Harry's just been over. I had a lovely surprise lined up for you, and now he's gone and ruined it.
She wept softly.
Don't upset yourself, Em. He's not worth it. I'll come straight over, and you can tell me all about it.
Chapter 4. The Bear and Penguin. Harry walked along Chatsworth Road and noticed the U.S. Army lorry in Millfields Park. 4 GIs were playing cards at a collapsible table next to it. They didn't look up as he passed. A cable curved up from it to a tethered balloon a few hundred feet overhead. There was an aluminum cabin hanging underneath, with an underslung turret. A pair of heavy machine guns projected from it. As Harry walked past the railing, the turret rotated around and its occupant brought the guns to bear on him. Harry waved a 2-fingered salute and called up.
I'm a rear gunner myself occasionally, mate.
He jerked his hips back and forth, laughing. The guns continued to track him as he walked on down the road. A few minutes later, Harry pushed through the doors of the salon bar of the Bear and Penguin. At the corner table, making a dog's breakfast out of rolling a cigarette, sat shaky Tom Fletcher. His hand stopped shaking as he looked up.
Thanks very much. I'll have a Guinness, please, Harry, since you ask.
Harry chuckled and ordered 2 pints at the bar, then walked over to Tom's table. Tom's hands were trembling again.
Hello, Tom,
said Harry, sitting down. He reached over, gently took the makings from Tom, and quickly finished rolling the cigarette, lit up, and took a grateful pull.
I thought that was for me,
said Tom, his hands trembling on the table in front of him.
Piss off, roll your own,
laughed Harry. He shrugged, then reached across the table for Tom's tobacco tin and rolled one for him.
You should smoke proper cigarettes, Tom, he said. It'd be much easier for you. I don't like the taste of tailor-mades, Harry. That's the trouble.
You're a man of the world, Tom. What's all this feet and inches stuff nowadays? Asked Harry.
Oh, well, it's all part of the government's Americanization campaign, I suppose.
Their drinks arrived and they clinked glasses.
Chin chin, said Tom. So, Harry, to what do I owe this unexpected pleasure?
I've got a job for you, Tom.
Sorry, Harry. I have certain responsibilities to my customers.
He parted one side of his jacket to show a bunch of small cloth and drawstring Coke bags hanging around his neck.
People are relying on me.
Harry tossed a bundle of white fibers on the table in front of him. It was thicker than the one he'd given to Emma. A second later, the notes were in Tom's pocket. His gaze had never left Harry's face.
I see. And, how can I help?
I need you to come up to Scotland with me and pick a few locks, Tom.
Tom and Harry were astride the Norton, leathered up. They'd been traveling for several hours. As Harry drifted the bike around the Scotch Corner roundabout and on up the A66 towards Glasgow, he overtook a number of steam buggies. One of them was driven by Telford Stephenson, but Harry didn't spot him as he wasn't wearing his trademark top hat. Harry sat in a booth in the whiskey bar of the Oran Moor public house and sipped on a dram of the Macallan. His left hand was roving under the table. His companion, a young draughtsman from Govan Shipbuilders, was sitting silently and very upright, a faraway look on his face.
I never thought about the accessibility a kilt gives, said Harry. I must get one of my own. Is there such a thing as Lampeter tartan, do you think?
I've really no idea, Mr. Lampeter.
Now, come on, Hamish. All I want to know is where they keep the drawings. Make a little plan. You ought to be good at that, being a draughtsman. Just a simple sketch.
Harry placed a piece of paper and a pencil in front of him. Let me know when you've finished, he said, as he ducked under the table and disappeared from view. Hamish drew the paper towards him and tried to concentrate.
I think you'll know when I'm finished, Mr. Lampeter, he muttered.
Earlier that afternoon, Telford Stephenson had arrived at the door of the design department at Govan Shipbuilders and walked through to Eileen Anderson's office. The sign proclaimed her Chief Mechanical Engineer. Telford knocked and let himself in.
Hello, darling, he said as he laid the drawing tube on her desk.
I've told you before, Telford. Don't call me darling at the office. I miss Anderson. It's hard enough dealing with these numpties at work here and call themselves engineers without them calling me darling behind my back.
Sorry, darling, said Telford.
Eileen sighed.
All right, what have you brought me?
Well, it's the drawings for the ironclad class of warships the Southerners are going to manufacture. All the latest weaponry, triple expansion steam engines, built of wood but with steel cladding above and below the waterline. Actually, they look rather like those broken-down trashpot things that one's always coming across. Sort of like tanks with slits for the chaps to push their muskets through.
Don't talk dirty, Telford.
Sorry, Eileen.
Here, let me have a look at them.
Eileen cast an expert eye over the drawings, while Telford pumped up the paraffin stove and made them both a cup of coffee. He sat quietly for a while, then walked out into the design area and rummaged around the drawing boards until he found a copy of The Scotsman. Back in Eileen's office, he sat and did the crossword. After about 3/4 of an hour, Eileen looked up.
I've seen enough. There's nothing here we can't duplicate. It'll take a year to build the first one, 6 months to build the second, as we'll have made all the templates and patterns.
She counter-rolled the drawings to flatten them, laid them in the top drawer of her drawing chest, closed it, and spun the combination lock. Telford stood, looking undecided as Eileen bustled into her coat and gathered her things.
All right, Telford, let's go back to my place and you can wine, dine, and have a lovely conversation with me.
Telford brightened up and followed her out of the door. Steampunk Confederation is one of the stories in Roger Lay's recently released speculative fiction collection, Dead People on Facebook. All the stories in the collection have been published, podcast, or broadcast in the last year, and steampunk author Jessica Lucci has included Dead People on Facebook in her January reading list for 2019. His other sci-fi book is Chronoscape, a science fiction novel about time and alternate realities. Hey guys, so that was part one of a 3-part series. I'll be airing the rest of the story over the next week and a half, so be sure to stay tuned. In the meantime, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe on either YouTube or on your favorite podcast player. And more recently, you can also find the show on Facebook if you prefer to go that route. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Herron, and that's it for today's Tall Tale TV.